Hello, on this week's programme, with the latest regional flurry of Andrew Wyeth fever dying down, we speak with director Anne Darnancourt about the Philadelphia Museum of Art's hugely successful Wyeth retrospective. Jason Pfeiffer speaks with the cast and creative team behind The Children of Fatima. Local playwright Michael Friel's unlikely comedy about growing up Catholic in Philadelphia during the Cold War opened at the Adrian Theatre this week. In our regular exploration of the Culture File section at gophila.com, we visit the Children's Garden in Camden. And art representing and inspired by kites has this summer been catching the eye in suburban Philadelphia. Susan Lewis investigates this latest Mainline Art Centre public art initiative. That's all I have this morning, creatively speaking.
Support for Creatively Speaking comes from the Greater Philadelphia Tourism Marketing Corporation, the Pennsylvania Council on the Arts, and the listeners of WRTI.
If you missed out on all of the Andrew Wyeth-related activities taking place throughout the region over the past 4 months or so, this weekend is your final chance to take in one of three shows of works by the man often referred to as America's greatest living painter. Wyeth exhibitions at the Brandywine River Museum and the Delaware Art Museum, as well as the blockbuster retrospective at the Philadelphia Museum of Art, which have been running concurrently, all end tomorrow. So pleased was the artist with the Philadelphia show in particular that he and his wife Betsy Wyeth recently donated 9 studies for Groundhog Day, one of his best-known paintings, to the museum. The Philadelphia Museum of Art show is called Memory and Magic, and when it opened in March, I asked Museum Director Anne Darnancourt why this title had been chosen.
Memory and magic really have to do with the fact that Wyeth, like all artists, but in him particularly intensely, he's using the store of memories and experiences and feelings to, he revisits them, and he revisits them or they are called up suddenly very sharply when he looks at something. I think it's You have the sense as you walk through the exhibition that objects that are depicted by him, whether it's a kettle or a rock or a small mussel by the side of the sea, a seashell, or the seashell in the wonderful painting Her Room, that seeing these objects, which he knows well, all of a sudden release. It's like touching a spring, a hidden spring in something that suddenly releases a jack-in-the-box of a feeling. And then the whole painting or the whole is about getting that feeling into the painting somewhere. That's why it's memory and magic. And the memory is the fact that these things, these spaces, these rooms, these hills, whatever they are, evoke some very strong memory or feeling, and then the magic is in fact that I think a lot of Wyeth's work has, if you will, a surreal quality, which a kind of he's not a camera recording, and not that it's fair about cameras, because of course cameras in the hands of different photographers plumb all kinds of depths. But in the it's not anything,
it's not photorealism.
It's not photorealism, and it's not mechanical. Whatever it is, it's not mechanical. He has extraordinary skill in teasing these memories and this sense of magic out of paint and out of watercolor and out of paper and onto the surface of his canvas or his pad of paper. But that's not the magic one refers to. The magic is somehow the connection. It's the sort of subterranean connection between the artist and what the painting is really about and the viewer who senses what the painting is about. And the interesting thing is, of course, every viewer brings their own experience. So we're not talking about, my standing in front of Groundhog Day and having the same experience that Andrew Wyeth has. Of course not. I mean, it's more what does it evoke in me? What trains of thought or trains of emotion or references does it set off in my mind?
Philadelphia Museum of Art director Anne Darnancourt. Andrew Wyeth's most iconic painting may well be Christina's World, an image of a young girl sitting stretched in a meadow gazing up a hillside at distant buildings. Reproductions of Christina's World, postcards and posters, are among the best-selling items at the Museum of Modern Art's souvenir shop. The work is notably absent from the exhibition in Philadelphia, as it's too fragile to travel. There are, however, several other instantly recognizable Wyeth paintings on view. Although beautifully crafted and executed, Wyeth's paintings can be understood on many different levels. WRTI's Susan Lewis explores.
Many people appreciate Wyeth as a great realistic painter, but his unadorned images belie different layers of meaning, says Kathleen Foster, curator of American art at the Philadelphia Museum of Art. She points to the boots in the title picture of the exhibition as a good example.
It's called Trodden Weed, and it shows Wyeth himself in boots, but you only see the lower half of his body, so you don't even recognize that it's a portrait. And that picture is full of personal stories for him. He had almost died in surgery when it was painted, and so it was a meditation about death. The boot is stepping on a weed, and he began to think about how death was so random and ever-present in the landscape, and the painting is about that. But also the boots are boots that belong to his father and to his father's teacher, and they're pirate boots. So he's becoming a pirate in this picture, and he's becoming his father and his father's teacher, and he's becoming a figure of death. So all those different allegories are present in the painting.
And while the name Andrew Wyeth brings to mind certain consistent imagery, this show demonstrates the diversity and range of his work, says Foster.
You can see the changes in color, the changes in paint handling, the changes in the ideas, but then certain consistent principles of imagination almost that have endured. So in some ways, he's been very steady, very consistent. In other ways, his style has changed dramatically.
However his style changed, Wyeth did not follow fashion, at least as defined by art circles in the 1960s. His persistent pursuit of his own vision in his own style placed him outside the mainstream. When critics turned their attentions to the great wave in abstract expressionism practiced by artists such as Willem de Kooning, Jackson Pollock, and Franz Klein, Anne Knutson, a guest curator from the High Museum in Atlanta where this exhibit first showed, says Andrew, or Andy, Wyeth was ignored and at times even vilified in professional circles.
In graduate school, we were all taught to just ignore his work because he wasn't painting in that abstract style when that was in vogue and popular.
Despite the fact that Wyeth followed his own path, Philadelphia Museum of Art curator Kathleen Foster emphasizes that he was not painting in a vacuum.
He was definitely absorbing ideas from all over the map. I mean, from the Renaissance and Albrecht Dürer right up to Edward Hopper and the regionalist painters of the 1930s. I'm quite sure that he was looking at the surrealists. We can see this from the work of the late 30s and the 40s. We have some of this work in the exhibition, and I think it will be some of the most surprising paintings to people.
Throughout his career, Wyeth's work has remained popular with the public, and today he has reemerged as an important living icon in the history of American art.
He was assigned to the margins by the critics. He, however, remained deeply popular, widely popular, to a large public. And so, in fact, that marginality, I think, was created by a margin of critics. However, given what was seen as the mainstream in New York City of abstraction, yes, he was seen as working on the sidelines. I think it's now, in the early 21st century, a moment where we can understand that many strains of art can be working simultaneously, that there isn't a single mainstream, and that someone like Wyeth, who sort of stayed true to his own personal credo, can have a vitality, a legitimacy, an integrity that is tremendously appealing now.
Andrew Wyeth, Master Drawings from the Artist's Collection, is at the Brandywine River Museum. Something Waits Beneath It, early work by Andrew Wyeth, 1939 to 1969, is at the Delaware Art Museum. Andrew Wyeth, Memory and Magic, is at the Philadelphia Museum of Art. All exhibitions run through July 16th.
Creatively Speaking, Susan Lewis.
You're listening to Creatively Speaking on WRTI.
In 1917, three shepherd children near the Portuguese village of Fatima claimed the Virgin Mary had appeared before them several times. The oldest of the children, Lucia Santos, said the Blessed Virgin had entrusted them with three secrets during these encounters. In 1942, Santos revealed the first two secrets, one involving a vision of hell and the other involving the Great World Wars and the rise of Russia. But the third secret was written down in a letter and sent to the Vatican, not to be read until 1960. As Cold War tensions grew in the late 1950s and early 60s, much speculation surrounded the contents of this writing, with suspicions that the third secret included predictions of nuclear attacks and World War III. The unopened letter helped to generate widespread anxiety and fear among many Catholics, especially children. This is the backdrop of the play The Children of Fatima, the latest production at the Adrian Theatre. Creatively Speaking's Jason Pfeiffer has more on the premiere of local playwright Michael Friel's unlikely comedy about growing up Catholic in Philadelphia during the Cold War.
Michael Friel describes The Children of Fatima as semi-autobiographical. While he's not recounting his own childhood experiences in the work, he does write about an era that he grew up in and draws on the experiences of many people he knows. According to Friel, those raised Catholic during the 50s and 60s share many similar stories.
Religion and life in general were much more conservative, and the attitude of those in power in the church and in government was basically, we're the boss, shut up and do as you're told. And I wanted to speak to the way that affected some people of my generation.
The Children of Fatima centers on the memories of 13-year-old Jerry, a baby boomer from the East Falls section of Philadelphia. As a student in the Catholic school system, Jerry becomes obsessed with the secret letter of Fatima, which is soon to be opened by the Vatican and rumored to speak of the end times. Jerry is consumed with apprehensions and questions about salvation and mortality. In this scene, the young Jerry, played by Keith Canallon, and his school friends Tony and Bernadette, played by Arnaldo Ortiz and Alice Whitley, grapple with some of the complexities of hell as they wait in line for confession.
It ain't fair.
What ain't?
Confession and committing sins. It's like God's always watching you.
He is.
Yeah, but it's like he's just trying to catch you doing something wrong so he can send you to hell.
Yeah, like Regina Celli, always looking around, always trying to nail you.
I used to think that I'd go to confession on Saturday and then to communion on Sunday, and then I'd have all that grace in my soul and I'd come home and kill myself and go straight to heaven, right after breakfast.
But that's a mortal sin. Killing yourself is one of the worst.
That's what I mean. There's too many sins. It's like God wants you to go to hell, ain't it? He's gonna send all of us to hell.
The Children of Fatima largely focuses on topics of faith, guilt, the questioning of religious institutions, and picking up the pieces of shattered beliefs. Michael Friel is well aware that he's handling some heavy issues.
And I feel that if you're dealing with something so serious, the best way to deal with it is through comedy. There was something I wanted to say about religion, and I thought I could do it in this play in a serio-comic vein.
Of course, a comedy about subject matter considered sacred by many people runs the risk of being offensive. While Friel says many of his devout Catholic friends have loved the play, others have indeed found it troubling and felt it was anti-Catholic.
I didn't set out to write a play of that nature. I just tried to be as truthful as I could, and some people will like it, some may be offended by it, but I think it's foolish to write a play just to offend people, but it's even worse to try to write with the idea of, oh, I can't offend anyone.
One friend of Michael Friel who is not offended by the comedy is Bud Martin. He directs the play. In 1969, Martin and Friel were freshman year roommates at DeSales University, then known as Allentown College. There, they both pursued their interest in theater, but lost contact with each other after graduation. When they finally did meet again a couple years ago, Martin found out about the Children of Fatima script, read and enjoyed it, and asked to direct it. The production gives Martin the opportunity to return to work about which he's deeply passionate. Following college and graduate school, he made a career of directing theater for nearly a decade before deciding to take up work in corporate finance.
I had a pretty intense career, but I struggled like many theater people do to support a family and three kids and, you know, go from show to show. And I got into business for a long time because an old friend of mine who was a producer said to me one time, he said, you know, your problem is you're trying to make a living. You know, go get rich and come back and, you know, have fun. And, you know, rich is a relative term, but at least I'm at the point now from a business career perspective where I actually can push back a little bit from work and try to do something that I've really wanted to do.
For Martin, some of the reasons for wanting to direct Children of Fatima involve his own religious upbringing during the Cold War era. He views the play as being profoundly relevant to his childhood experiences over 40 years ago. Although not raised during the height of the Cold War, 27-year-old Keith Canallon, who plays the lead character, Jerry, also finds resonance with the story.
For me, the excitement with doing this show is, number one, it does connect with me on that level of being raised Catholic, understanding the religion and the faith.
Growing up in South Philadelphia, a neighborhood with a strong Catholic presence, Canallon thinks the local themes in the play could draw people from his hometown to see the show, even those who are not regular theatergoers.
I think that with this show, a lot of the South Philly community could be introduced to theater, you know, and have a strong connection to it. And I think that'll get them in, and I think it'll be a great thing for Philadelphia itself.
The Philadelphia production of Children of Fatima marks the first time the play has been produced professionally, But the piece has been seen before. It received a staged reading with the Philadelphia Theater Company in 1997, and a full production was later put on by Rider University in New Jersey. With the latest rendition of the play at the Adrian, Michael Friel says he's happy to approach the end of the lengthy creative process.
I remember reading something by Terrence McNally who said that if you're not willing to invest five or more years in the play, maybe it's not worth it. So I'm up to year nine now, and I'm hoping that this might be all I have to invest in it.
The Philadelphia premiere of The Children of Fatima is being produced by Theater Catalyst, a nonprofit corporation whose mission is to further the development of small theater companies and individual artists.
Creatively Speaking's Jason Pfeiffer. The Children of Fatima is at the second stage of the Adrian on 2030 Sampson Street in Philadelphia through August 6th. Now it's time for our regular dip into the Culture File section of GoPhila.com. Entering Camden Children's Garden begs the question, is this the Mad Hatter's Tea Party? No, this is the Picnic Garden, where cups and bowls are as big as cars, and inside the colourfully painted tableware are real vegetables. The vegetables are not oversized, but at the right time of year, they are perfectly edible. The giant bowls and cups serve as garden plots, inside which are herbs and vegetables. Kids peer in and try to name the vegetables they know.
No! Eggplant, different kinds of plants like collard greens, tomatoes, and apples. What did he say in the street?
Others jump around waiting for the sprinkler system to go off or trying to figure out how to climb on the larger-than-life ants. The ants aren't real, but it wouldn't be a picnic without them. There are, however, some real bugs lurking around this garden.
They go, ew!
Betsy Payne is the educator at the Camden Children's Garden. She's imitating the kids when she first offers them the chance to touch these more wiggly inhabitants of the garden.
They usually try to get them to touch one of the earthworms. And that is always the first thing. Of course, everybody goes, ew. And then after the first one holds it, then everybody wants to hold it. And then we talk about the importance of the worms and the soil and the ecosystem. So it's definitely something that they wouldn't do normally. You know, some kids are adventurous, but most of the kids, it's the first time that they even consider touching a worm.
Camden Children's Garden is open to the public and attracts visitors from all over the Delaware Valley. They do, however, have a number of outreach programs with the schools and communities right here in Camden, which is one of the nation's poorest and most dangerous cities. This means for many of the kids living here, very little outdoor time or outdoor space is normally available.
We have kids that never seen half this much nature. We do some lessons in the garden, and usually I try to make sure that they put their hands in the soil or something like that, and that's something they never do either. I mean, there's kids that have never actually done that, been able to plant a seed or just play in the soil and get dirty and have fun.
On this sunny day, the kids are definitely having fun, jumping, running, crouching. The birds are chirping and the trees are in full bloom. Philadelphia's skyline is visible across the glistening river, and the popular Camden Aquarium is right next door. It seems easy to forget the problems of the city while inside this enchanted urban oasis, but everything in the garden has relevance to the outside world, as Executive Director Mike Devlin explains.
It's to let them know that we can't live without nature, we can't live without horticulture, and to that maybe at the end of the day, kids can thank a tree for having existed and help produce the oxygen they breathe, the wood that builds their homes and other buildings, and to take a little bit of care of nature.
The garden teaches the children to appreciate by enjoying and by playing. According to Devlin, this is one of the reasons a children's garden exists and what makes it different from other botanical gardens or arboretums.
It's more hands-on. There are not a lot of do not touch, there are no do not touch signs here. Children come into a natural space and they want to climb things, they want to run, they have a lot of energy, they want to exercise both the body and the mind, and you have to build things a little differently and with more strength and care. Softer spaces, softer sculptures, things like that, because children want to climb and get around.
Mixed with the natural world are whimsical man-made props and sculptures, all recycled from the garden's past exhibits at the Philadelphia Flower Show. One obvious favorite is the Storybook Garden, inhabited by larger-than-life characters from such tales as The Three Little Pigs, The Frog Prince, Alice in Wonderland, and gardener Jeff Clark's personal favorite.
You talk about Jack and the Magic Beanstalk, and you plant pole beans, and they actually see them grow 10 feet tall. And I like the wonderment factor to go home and sit and think about, wow, where's that whole big plant come from? You know, I see a 10-foot sunflower growing, and they think it came from that little tiny seed like that.
In addition to teaching about the real-life magic of growth, the garden also focuses on practical matters such as recycling. Gazing at the waterfall is an Apatosaurus standing tall. The friendly-looking dinosaur is made of recycled car parts. Walking through the Red Oak Run, a tunnel-like maze of trees, Bark points to the ground, which doesn't look too different from the ground in many public playgrounds.
It's all made from recycled tires. It looks like a mulch down there, but it's all laid down with recycled tires, so it's another way to recycle products through the garden.
There's also a tree house to peer down from, the ever-popular butterfly house, and many other magical surprises, both big and small, just like nature itself.
I saw different butterflies, and I saw they cocoons. It's all, about, it's all different kinds of butterflies, and there's more than one butterfly in the world. And you cannot touch them. They got scales. If you touch it, they got some type of powder on them. If you touch them, if you touch them, the powder come off. And when it's rain, it'd be hard for them to fly. It was a spider, and the butterfly got trapped in a web, and a man came and got it and was taking all the webs off of it.
More information on the Camden Children's Garden is available at the Culture File section of gofilla.com. If you're around the mainline this summer, you'll come across some unfamiliar sights in the landscape. In front of local businesses and on green, leafy corners, sculptures have sprouted on 12-foot poles, all part of a local arts organization's efforts to bring more public art to the Philadelphia suburbs. WRTI's Susan Lewis reports.
About 4 years ago, Philadelphia's mainline suburbs went to the dogs, or rather, dogs went to the mainline. In Art Unleashed, artist-decorated fiberglass dogs showed up on business doorsteps, sidewalks, and public spaces. The exhibit was motivated by similar animal-inspired public art initiatives in other cities. A 1998 cow exhibit in Zurich, Switzerland, was followed by cows in Chicago, fish in New Orleans, pigs in Cincinnati, not to mention frogs in Toledo and horses in Kentucky. A movement was underway. The exhibits, tied thematically to the city's histories, have sparked criticism and public controversy about what is art, a debate which may have been dampened somewhat by the dollars some exhibits have brought in. The Big Pig Gig in Cincinnati, for example, reportedly generated $124 million in economic activity. Judy Herman, executive director of Mainline Center for the Arts, the organization responsible for the dogs, says her latest brainchild fell, well, literally out of the sky.
I saw a kite flying above a house in Lower Merion Township and thought, wouldn't this make a great public art idea?
An active proponent of public art, Herman took the kite idea and ran with it, so to speak. With local businesses as sponsors, the center created a juried competition and put out a call to artists to create sculptures somehow related to kites. The kite idea was more open-ended than the exhibits using animal molds, but it tied into the celebration of Philadelphia's most famous kite flyer, as project manager Mary Salvante describes.
It was also to commemorate Ben Franklin's 300th birthday, so some artists chose to focus more on that. Some artists combined the two, so it allowed for a lot of variety and different interpretations.
It would seem a challenge to create an expression of kites and flight and attach it to a 12-foot pole anchored in a base of cement. But the weight, height, and size parameters were required, says Herman, by practical considerations.
We get winds that are really strong, and for the townships to be comfortable with it, we had to make sure that they weren't going anywhere, even though they were kites. The pole is really to get them off and out of the walking space.
In November of last year, from about 50 submissions, jurors chose 38 artists, who then produced 41 sculptures with a variety of materials and thematic interpretations. Some artists turned right to Benjamin Franklin, like Elizabeth Miller McHugh, a sculptor accustomed to working with brass, whose sculpture is called A Penny Saved is a Penny Earned.
I went to Poor Richard, and I chose a phrase to work with. As a kite image, it has a triangulation, and the bottom part of the arms with the pennies coming off are like tails of a kite. But it's true, when you look at it, you don't immediately say, that is a kite.
For mosaic artist John Mandel, the idea of a kite brought to mind not Benjamin Franklin, but John Lennon. And, of course, Paul, George, and Ringo.
I'm a Beatles fan, so I remember they had from Sgt. Pepper's the song Being for the Benefit of Mr. Kite. The song is based on an antique circus poster that John Lennon had bought from an antique store in London. They created the song from the artwork, and I created my artwork from the song based on the original artwork.
Still other artists, like self-described pop artist Jeff Shaler, accustomed to painting in wax with natural pigments, approached the theme in a playful, straightforward way. He looked around his studio and saw a character image he uses a lot in his work.
He's a sort of like a 1950s guy with his hand out with the fedora hat and the business suit. Just sort of looks like he's going to sell you a car. And then because it was a kite theme, I put a kite in his hand.
Shaler ended up with three sculptures in the show. Once chosen, the artists had to translate their ideas to works of art that would fit the size and weight parameters, withstand the elements, and also satisfy their own artistic visions. John Mandel listened to the Beatles a lot and figured out how to apply his own technique.
The different neat things that you can do with mosaic that you can't do with paint, your grout joints or your drawing lines. As an example, in doing John Lennon's portrait, his eyeglasses are made from the grout joints.
Elizabeth McHugh has done public art before. In the Fringe Festival, she created a lamb out of a shopping cart and a turtle that could be played by a percussionist. But with the kite project, creating such a tall sculpture was the first of several challenges.
The pennies move. They're drilled through aluminum wire that's all bent. Each wire length is about 25 feet. And making the wire bend, it's like doing dancing out in my studio, stepping on them, bending them, warping them. It was lots of fun.
By April, the sculptures were completed. Artists installed their works at spots chosen by the sponsors. The result? Kites and kite-inspired art all over Lower Merion Township and a bit beyond. The territory, says Herman, stretches all the way from Lankenau Hospital to Radnor and branches into Havertown along Darby Road. And the point of all this public art spread out through the suburbs? Unlike some of its urban counterparts, its success will probably not be measured in terms of economic activity. But there are other rewards, says Herman, who considers the project a populist as opposed to high art project.
They are there for people to smile at, to laugh at, to seriously consider as whether public art should be in the environment all the time.
The artists agree.
I think it engages the mind visually, intellectually. It's something fun to stumble onto in a way. It might be unexpected.
I'm with her, yeah. I think you need public art. It just breaks up the monotony of everyday life. When putting up this kite, everybody was honking and being like, hey, and it's just cool, and there's just sort of a lot of buzz and makes people get outdoors and like look around again.
And while the intent may be to engage the audience community, projects like this also nurture and support local artists, giving them recognition and sometimes leading them down new creative paths, as John Mandel describes.
From having done the dog competition, that pushed my mosaic in a different direction. I was applying my mosaic in a pictorial way, jacketing this dog form, and I hadn't really done a lot with sculpture with the mosaic, and it allowed me to push this pictorial mosaic thing in this direction of applying it to sculptural form. And in this case, with the kite, it pushed me in a direction I was creating my own sculpture forms, which I hadn't really done since I was in my MFA.
Ultimately, public art fosters a sense of connection and community among those who happen upon it and among the artists themselves. After months of working alone, they say it's fascinating to see how other ideas turned out.
It's cool. Yeah, it's just great to see other people's stuff.
The sculptures are on display through October, when they will be auctioned off, with most of the proceeds benefiting the Mainline Center for the Arts. A link to the map showing exact locations can be found at our website at www.wrti.org.
WRTI's Susan Lewis. And that's it for now. Our program written and produced by Teresa Madden and myself, with thanks this week also to Cheryl Squadrido, Norman Keyes, Tracy Tomchick, and Megan Smedley. Creatively Speaking's theme music is by Bill Jolly. Our executive producer is Jack Moore, and I'm Jim Calder.
Creatively Speaking is a production of WRTI in Philadelphia. Support for the program comes from the Greater Philadelphia Tourism Marketing Corporation, the Pennsylvania Council on the Arts, and the listeners of WRTI.